welcome Steph from South College Speaker Group in Newark, Delaware.
It's too high for a short person. Hi, everyone. I'm Steph. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steph.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I've been up to this meeting a few times before, and it's always a real pleasure to come. You guys are such a welcoming group. That's what I try to bring my home group as well. So anyway, I guess just formalities out of the way. I have a sobriety date. It's October 3rd of 2009. My home group, South College Speakers Group, we meet Wednesday nights at 8:30. I know a lot of you guys have been there. That's been my home group since I got sober. But now I'm getting a little bit older, and I'm just like, 8:30, that's really late. That's like really late for a meeting. I don't know if I can keep doing it. So I'm sort of in the process of trying to find another group that maybe is a better fit for my work schedule. And also I have a sponsor. I've been through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I sponsor other women, and most importantly in having that experience because I did that work because I try to practice those principles. Our 12-step promises us that we will have a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. I did have that, and I do believe that that is the reason I am sober today, because I tried a lot of other things before I tried that, which all were pretty ineffective. So anyway, just a little bit of honesty here. I'm not at my best right now. I'm not feeling that good, to be honest. I have a really bad headache, and I'm usually like a little bit animated. but I'm just not feeling that well. So bear with me, you guys. I've just been told that it's my job to share with you my experience, what things were like for me and what happened and what it's like now. And despite the headache, I'm going to try to do that. So anyway, I always start, I guess, before I ever picked up a drink of alcohol, because as our literature points out, I don't think that alcohol was really my problem. I had a lot of emotional problems before I ever picked up a drink of alcohol. I was born in Brazil, two parents. They were awesome, terrific people. And I grew up with pretty much every everything I needed and most of the luxuries that you would want in your life. My dad was an intellectual, and he was a really gross overachiever. He had two PhDs, and he had an awesome job, and he was just a very good provider for my family, and education was stressed in my home, and getting involved in all sorts of other things was stressed in my home. Just being like a well-rounded person was stressed in my home. And, so I had all these amazing opportunities afforded to me. But that being said, though, I was an only child, and I was like pretty typical only child, like very spoiled, got everything I wanted. And just like a horrible, nasty little bitch if I didn't get what I wanted. Then you would pay. And when I was around 5 years old, we moved to Delaware, so that's pretty much where I grew up. And like I said, I mean, I went to school. It was pretty much expected of me to get good grades, but my parents got me involved in a lot of other things. You know, like I was a horseback rider and an ice skater, and I was a very kind of weird theater kid when I was young as well. So I was in drama and that sort of thing. So I had all these great opportunities. But not just that, like, I do believe that my parents tried everything that they possibly could to teach me how to appreciate those opportunities, not just hand them to me. My mom was a Christian woman. She took me to church every Sunday, and every night she would tuck me into bed and she would say my prayers with me. She would teach me how to pray, and I just, like, what are you doing? Like, it just seemed very, it was never something that was attractive to me. See, what was attractive to me was being impressive. I want to be impressive. I want everybody to look at me and know that I'm better than you. That's really what I wanted at that time in my life. So, like, I wanted to have everything I possibly could, every material possession I possibly could, because I needed to impress you. And I couldn't necessarily tell you that that's what it was at that time. It's just, it was the only thing that kind of made me feel some semblance of purpose. Like, it was the only sense of, I guess, like, fulfillment that I really knew, is that the satisfaction that I would get if I impressed you. And of course, that was entirely in my head. Like, I didn't know if I was impressing anybody. Probably not, because I was like a horrible, spoiled little brat. But, you know, that's what I thought. So for, you know, pretty much the only thing I can say about it was a good childhood. The one thing that I do like to talk about as well is that alcohol was always present in my home. My dad was an alcoholic. His alcoholism looked a lot different than mine. He was able to go a little bit further in his life, you know, before it became an issue. And I don't think that's what makes me an alcoholic. The reason I share it is because of that line in the doctor's opinion of our book that says, our alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. And alcohol was always there. It was always there, every night, present, part of the family. That's what you did, you drank. And I would watch my dad drink, and it seemed very glamorous to me. You know, and it also wasn't necessarily a problem if I drank. And I don't say that to tell you that my parents are like, here, like, guzzle this vodka. Like, no, that's not what they were doing. They would let me have a taste of their wine. My dad would, like, make me a little bit of a frozen margarita and put it in a Cinderella cup, and it was cute. And that's what it was. Like, it was never a problem, and that could be, like, a cultural thing as well. But it was always present. But my dad drank Wild Turkey, and he'd put it in a rocks glass. And I remember, like, I'd have a sip of my mom's wine, or, you know, if she was drinking a Corona, I'd have a sip of that. But I wanted that Wild Turkey, like, because here's what I saw of my dad. My dad was a dick. And when he would get home from his job, he would be, like, angry and miserable and just, like, F the world. And then he'd have a drink of that Wild Turkey. And suddenly he was, like, fun. You know what I mean? Like, he would sing and he would dance and it was fun. And he was a nice guy. And I really liked when my dad drank that Wild Turkey. So I thought that there was something pretty glamorous about that. And that's what I wanted. So, you know, when I'm, like, 7 or 8 years old, sure, I'm allowed to have a sip of the Corona. But what I do is sometimes when my parents are asleep, I'll go downstairs and I'll try to drink that Wild Turkey. You know what I mean? And I'll sneak it upstairs in my little Cinderella cup. And, you know, I don't really know what normal is, but I don't think that that is it. I don't know if children normally see alcohol in that sense, but it was always an attraction. There was always a pull to it for me. But aside from that, life was pretty good. And when I was 11 years old, this kind of family life that I had become accustomed to changed pretty dramatically. My dad's alcoholism had become a little bit more of an issue, and he lost his very good paying job. So I couldn't be a spoiled brat anymore, which is very traumatic if you're a spoiled brat. But that same year, my mom, who had had no history of it before, developed schizophrenia. And, you know, there were periods where she was severely depressed. There were periods where she was catatonic. There were periods where she was paranoid and violent. And it just became a very tumultuous household. It became a household not like the one that I had known as a kid. And that's a perfect excuse, right? We all come in here with a lot of excuses, and that would become mine for the next 10 years. And I just kind of, you know, that's when my drinking escalated quite a bit, and I would take water bottles full of my dad's liquor with me to school. And, you know, the thing about that was, is like, yes, I would have told you. I would have absolutely told you, well, I am like this. I drink because, well, look at my parents. You don't understand what this is like. And I, like I said, I held on to that for a long time. I would have told you, like, when I was 22 years old, this is the reason why I'm a degenerate. Like, look at what I had growing up. And I'm very thankful for the perspective that Alcoholics Anonymous gives us, because here's what I can see today. When I was 7 years old, I used to sneak downstairs to try to steal some wild turkey. I cannot blame my alcoholism on my circumstances, because even when my circumstances were completely ideal, like what every kid would want in their life, I was still not okay, you know? So I'm very, very grateful that I can stop blaming that on all the external things and really realize that this is an internal problem. But anyway, of course, I didn't know that at this time. So anyway, I'm taking water bottles full of liquor with me to school. And, you know, when you're like 11 or 12, like people notice that and they don't think that it's good. So I started seeing like a lot of like the school counselors and then counselors outside of school and therapists and psychiatrists and all these things. And I had a lot of very well-intentioned people who were trying to help me. And I really wasn't interested in that because I already knew what was effective for me. And what was effective for me was drinking alcohol. See, I've always lived in this world where I am just consumed with the thoughts of what I think you're thinking. And that's horribly uncomfortable because for some reason, like the way that I think of it, you're never thinking anything that's good. and the freedom that alcohol gave me was being, you know, I just didn't care. You know, I just didn't care if you were thinking that. Like suddenly it wasn't the dominant thought in my mind. And that is freedom. That's a very powerful experience to have when you've spent your entire life consumed with the fear of whatever it is you guys think about me. So I needed it, you know? So like, of course, all these very well-intentioned people, I'm not listening to them, but they have a lot of ideas of what's wrong with me. And, you know, some of you may have heard these things before. It's like, it's depression and it's severe depression with delusions and it's anxiety disorder and it's bipolar and, you know, eventually it became borderline personality disorder, which basically the prognosis is like, well, can't really help you. I'm sorry about your life. Like, here's some medication. And that's just what it was. Like, I was super, super highly medicated because people were trying to keep me under control. And I started going in and out of psych wards. I think in high school I was in, you know, mental institutions 11 times, I think it was. And just, so, you know, I couldn't keep it together. What I found is that some of these medications that they provided me mixed really well with my dad's alcohol, and I didn't need as much of the alcohol, so it was very effective. You know, so that's what I would do at school, and that's what I would do at home, and, like, that was just life. That was the extent of my ambition, which is sad. But that was it. But one day I did a little bit too much of my medication and I drank a little bit too much and I ended up waking up, or I should say coming to, in a hospital. And I had been out for a couple of days and I had apparently died and flatlined and they resuscitated me. And my mom was actually in a period of stability at this point in time and the difference between my mom and I is when my mom overcomes some kind of incredibly difficult experience, such as her schizophrenia. When she comes out of that, she thanks God. You know what I mean? She's not bitter. She's not resentful. She's not self-pity. She thanks God. And for me, like, I just want to blame everybody. But anyway, so I come out of this, and she, you know, had an idea about what could be the solution to this problem, and she thought it was God. And I think she was right, but I was just, you know, obviously I was not at the point where I was, that was of any interest to me. And she ended up sending me to a Christian rehab, which was fun. Like, as a teenager, I kind of turned into, I wore all black all the time, and I carved anarchy symbols into the lockers at school, and, you know, like, everything I owned had an anarchy symbol in Sharpie written on it. Like, I thought I was super punk rock, and you know, so they sent me to a Christian rehab, and it was like a bed and a nightstand with a Bible, and I was like, this is not gonna work. Like, no, like I was completely turned off to the experience. Like, I wanted no part of it whatsoever. And because of that, like, I didn't try to retain anything. I didn't try to have an experience with what they were trying to teach me. I just counted down the days until I could get out. And because of that, I don't really remember very much about that experience. But the one thing that I do remember is something excuse me, that has come back to me since I've gotten sober. And I don't think it was particularly significant to me at the time, but the reason it's significant to me now is because I think, well, there is the picture-perfect conversation of an alcoholic's mentality. And a pastor in this program asked me, like, why I was doing this, like, why I felt the need to do these things. I suppose he was asking me about triggers or something like that. And my answer was life, you know? Like, I don't need an excuse aside from that. And I remember when I came in this time, I was listening to a guy from my home group speak, and he was talking about a time he was in rehab, and one of his counselors asked him what his triggers were, and he, like, thought about this for a minute, and then he said, air. And I just thought that that was, like, some profound shit. Like, I had never heard anybody describe it in that way. Like, I don't need to see, you know, a liquor store or, you know, see a spoon, and suddenly I'm like, I must have it now. Like, it's just on me all the time. Like, it's always there. I always want it. There's nothing I can do about it. There's nothing I can change it, and none of the things that you guys have tried to help has ever been effective to make this stop. It was the first time I had really, like, holy shit, you get that too? And but anyway, I got out of this rehab, and I guess, like, this was the first time I attempted to control my drinking, because the fact that I had about died scared me. And I did get to the point in my drinking where I wanted to die, but I was not there yet. So the fact that I almost had, I was like, okay, like, let's take a step back. You know, we're going to control this. And just to give you an idea of, like, what control was. So my idea of control at this time is, like, you can drink as much as you want, whenever you want, just don't shoot heroin. And I really thought that that was having control of whatever my illness was. So that's exactly what I did. And I get out of rehab, and I'm about to enter my senior year of high school. And I remember us going downstairs because I was going to take some of my dad's liquor. And I remember my mom stood in front of me like a good mother. She didn't want to let me go down this road again. And when she stood in front of me, I attacked her. I just viciously attacked her, because alcohol was more important to me than you. Alcohol was more important to me than anything. And don't ever stand in the way of me and my alcohol, because I will do whatever I have to do to get it. And that's exactly what I did. And I didn't think that that was an abnormal reaction. You know what I mean? Like, I did not think that was abnormal at all, but other people did. So I went to I guess it was like an inpatient psychiatric facility for my senior year of high school. That's where I was. And you would think that that would be a pretty extraordinary consequence, like, hey, become aware of these horrible actions you're taking. But I really didn't think it was that bad, because I just had to, like, fill out packets for school, and it was like two classes, two packets, and they gave you Xanax. So I thought it was a pretty sweet deal for high school senior year. And, you know, I end up graduating. And I had a lot of people telling me that I was smart and I should go to college and I should do this and I should do that. And the thing about me is that I have, like, always innately known that I would fail. Like, I just knew I would fail. Now, of course, I can't tell you that. Right, like, I can never let you in on this secret that I know how, you know, pathetic I am. So I have to, like, play it off as, like, something cool, you know. I have to, like, play it off as, like, something like punk rock. So, you know, my parents and, you know, my counselors in the facility that I were in were telling me, like, think about college, and I was like, no, like, I refuse to be a part of the establishment. you know, so instead of going to college and trying to do something with my existence, I got a job at Dunkin' Donuts, and which is not the establishment, if you were wondering. And so I get a job there. I'm working like an afternoon into evening shift. There's one other person on the shift with me who also likes to get loaded. So it was a pretty sweet deal. Like, I was making a little bit of money. I got loaded at work. I didn't care. And the front of this Dunkin' Donuts that I worked at faced the back of a diner. And I'm sure you guys, some of you guys have worked in diners, so you know that we like to frequent diners. We like to work there. So I would see the employees of this diner walking out the back. And they would be, like, hiding behind the dumpsters, like, doing things that they should not be doing. Namely, smoking things they probably should not have been smoking. And, you know, so I would watch them and, you know, those are my people, you know. So I remember that I saw this one guy and I would watch him frequently. And I don't know if any of the other ladies can relate to this, but, like, my favorite quality in a man is that he is a just like filthy junkie. And so I would watch this guy come out, and he was really pale, and he had this like emaciated look about him. He wore a skull cap with an anarchy A on it. So I was like, well, he will be my boyfriend. And so I made him my boyfriend for like 7 years. And probably not good, but it was fine. But anyway, at this point in my life, I had a At this point in my life, I didn't really have a lot of friends because I was never really good at like the being socially friendly thing, because I steal and I lie, so you probably wouldn't want to be my friend. And not shortly thereafter, after I met this guy, my parents had asked me to leave their home because they said you can get sober or you can leave, and I was like, see ya. And I left, and I was spending pretty much the only person in my life at that point was that boyfriend that I had gotten. And we just ran around like crazy, and we had fun. Like, I'm not here to paint the picture that I didn't have fun. Like, I had a great time. I was 18 years old, so I couldn't have people, like, volunteering me to another trip to the psych ward. I was very excited about that, or another trip to rehab or whatever the case was. I had a good time. But we ended up getting in some trouble, and the court said to him, well, you need to go to AA. And, you know, I can be, like, a relatively logical person. So I knew that if he had to be sober in AA, that if I wasn't sober, that he would probably break up with me, because sober people are supposed to be with other sober people or something like that. Like, you're not allowed to shoot drugs in front of your boyfriend that's sober or something like that. So, so anyway, I decided I was going to attempt this, like, sobriety thing. And the difference between him and I is he, like, came in and he, like, started hanging out with a group of guys, and he would go to meetings, and he got a home group, and he started going through the steps, and things became very different for him. And I walked into these meetings, and I was, like, absolutely horrified. You know, I hear a lot of people say that when they showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous, they immediately felt very connected to the energy in this room. And, like, I absolutely don't doubt that that's your experience. That just wasn't my experience. Like, I came in here, and I was absolutely horrified by you people. And it's because I just didn't understand it. You know, one of the first meetings I had ever gone to was my home group today, South College Speakers. And it's a pretty big meeting, and people there are pretty shiny and content. And when you're walking up and they haven't met you before, they try to meet you. And I just did not trust that. And, like, furthermore, like, not only did I not trust it, I just have no concept of how to respond to it. Like, when people are being kind and friendly, I'm just like, what? I don't know what to do with myself. I don't know what to say when you ask me how I'm doing. I don't know what to say if you say I want to go to the diner. Like, I just didn't know how to respond to it. So I would run in the meeting late, and I would leave the meeting early. And then when people started calling me out on that, I would get loaded in my car before the meeting. So I had something to to give me some kind of direction when I walked in there, which is really pathetic, right? But yeah, that's what I would do. Because alcohol has always been what's given me direction. And obviously that was pretty ineffective, and I had lots of women who tried to help me and tried to offer me this program, and I just was uninterested in that because I already knew what was effective. The problem is I didn't know that very soon it would no longer be effective. You know, so I leave. I was still with that sober boyfriend, and he was still sober. But I was hiding what I was doing, and I was getting loaded as frequently as I could. There was so much relief in that at first. And then that dissipated. And the only way I can describe it is I have always paid consequences for my drinking. You know, since I was a kid, I paid consequences for my drinking. Just minor trouble, like having to go to another psych ward, having to go to rehab, you know, trouble at school, blah, 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 blah. Like, I've always paid these consequences, and the consequences were pretty insignificant to me. The consequences didn't mean very much to me because the effect that alcohol gives me is far more powerful than any of those consequences. It is so worth it to get the effects produced by alcohol. And what ended up happening is I continued to drink. And of course, I didn't have a choice in the matter of whether or not I drank. But I continued to drink, and suddenly, like, I would start paying some consequences, even if it was minor. And suddenly I would have to experience the pain of that. And I really didn't get it, because that was something completely foreign to me. Like, I had never actually had to feel that pain if I had the drink. You know, so I really didn't know what was wrong with me. And I convinced myself that I was schizophrenic, because suddenly I'm drinking and drinking and drinking, and there's too much going on in my mind. Like, I can't stop it. Nothing shuts it up. It's always there. It's always present. I need it to go away. It won't stop. Drink more. Won't stop. Drink more. Won't stop. And this is what happened. Like, in this period of time, I tried to get sober a few times, and what I found is that sobriety would become so heavy and just so confusing. Like, I have no idea what to do when I'm sober. I remember sitting in the parking lot of a Wawa, like, wanting to go in and buy cigarettes and being so consumed by fear at the idea of having to walk in there and people would look at me and what do I say? Like, where do I put my hands? Where do I look? Like, all this stuff, and that's, like, sober. Now, if you're experiencing that sober, you got to drink. You have to drink. You have to take it away. But I would drink, and it would still be there. So I thought I was schizophrenic. And I remember going to this sober boyfriend, and I said to him that I was schizophrenic, and he needed to put me in Delaware State Hospital, which is a mental institution that we have back home. And he just said, no, you're not. And I, you know, we argued about this for a time because I needed to convince him, yes, I am. that was the more reasonable alternative to alcoholism. And he didn't tell me, you know, he didn't pronounce me alcoholic or anything. What he told me, he said, why don't you pray? Which, I don't know if you guys have been new and somebody tells you to pray. And you're just like, that is the most scandalous thing I've ever heard in my life. That is the least tangible piece of guidance I have ever had in my life. And I was just at that point where it was the only piece of guidance I had. You know, so I said the prayer, right? And he told me to pray for God's will. Which, like, what does that mean? I don't know what that means. But I said the prayer. And I didn't know what it meant, but I meant it as much as I could possibly mean it. And I said it, and I drank. And I said it, and I drank, and I said it, and I drank. And this went on for about a month. And it was literally just... it was drinking all day, every day. The only difference between that month-long period and previous periods is that I happened to be saying this prayer. And to be honest, I don't really remember what happened, that I ended up in detox. I don't know, like, when that was decided, if that was something I initiated it. if that was somebody, you know, somebody had just like taken me and said like, you're gonna get out of my house if you don't. But I just ended up in detox, and I get out, and I wasn't gonna go back to AA, because here's my idea of what AA is. You guys were like, man, I drink a lot, I'm gonna stop. And then you did. And I really thought that that was the extent of the experience you guys were having here, that you guys made a firm resolution to not drink again. And you stuck with it. Now, you couldn't possibly understand why I had to drink. You couldn't possibly understand that. So I wasn't going to go back there. So I get out of detox, and I'm a couple weeks sober, and I'm like horribly uncomfortable. And once again, can't even go into the Wawa for a pack of cigarettes because it is too hard. Sobriety is way too hard. I can't do it. Once again, I'm not even sure how this happened, but I did end up in a meeting. And ironically, that meeting was about an hour and a half away from my house, which was, once again, like pretty scandalous, the idea of that. Why would it be an hour and a half away? But I happened to be there, and I was absolutely, like, I was petrified. I couldn't talk to anybody. I sat down and glared and, like, you know, just judged whatever it happened to be. And then I this speaker gets up there, and I hear this speaker talking about when he drank, it just made things change. It made things change for the better. And he kept drinking. And then suddenly the change wasn't there anymore. But then he couldn't stop drinking. And then he ended up getting sober, and he was overwhelmed constantly. And, like, I'm sure he said it in a much more eloquent way. But, like, the way he described that, it was the first time that I trusted that somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous had the same thing that I had. It was the first time I had ever heard somebody describe alcoholism in that way. And I was amazed that somebody actually knew what it was like. And I wish that, you know, I wish that that would make me ask for help. But no, like, I am way too consumed with self to do that. So after that meeting, I go and I, like, stand in a corner, because I'm not talking to you. And I try to look as angry as I possibly can. And I was wearing all black, and, like, my hair used to be dyed black, so I looked a lot more, like, sad and angry than I do now. At least that's what people have told me. But anyway, so I just try to look as angry as possible, because I don't want anybody coming near me. I don't know how to talk to you. And I see this girl approaching me, and I was just, like, willing her away with my mind powers. And she kept coming towards me, and I was just, like, with each passing step, I was like, no, bitch, like, don't come over here. And she did. And she was all, like, smiling and happy. And see, people who have recovered from alcoholism do not wait for the sick and suffering to walk up to them and say, I need your help. They can see, like, who the sick and suffering is, and they go up and offer it freely, and that's exactly what she was doing. She could see right through me. I wasn't angry. I was a scared child. And she had, like, this program to offer me. I didn't know what that program was, but for some reason, when she asked me how I was doing, which is a pretty loaded question, I didn't used to know how to answer it. For some reason, when she asked me how I was doing, it was just like, I told her I couldn't do it. Like, I will drink. I know. Like, this is a matter of time. And I don't really remember the words exchanged very much. What I do remember is that she did become my sponsor. She started taking me through the steps immediately. And that was very necessary. As soon as she gave me a piece of direction, like, I did that piece of direction. If she told me to pray, I prayed. If she told me to write, I wrote. If she told me to sit, you know, still for an hour, I was like, all right, I'll try it. Not really good at that, but I tried. And I went through the steps in a week and a half. I'm not saying that that has to be your experience. I'm saying it was mine and it was effective. And the reason it was so effective is because I literally had no concept of what to do sober. Like, I couldn't move. I was paralyzed. And she gave me those directions, those concrete, this is what you do now, here's what you do now, and I had something to keep me going, and that's exactly what I did. And I'm not going to paint the picture either that after a week and a half, I was like, you know, good. Like, I was still crazy, but it was just enough, you know what I mean? It was just enough for me to keep going. It was just enough for me to be comfortable enough that I said, oh my God, something in AA really works. This is actually like an effective thing. Let me keep doing it. And with each step I went through and, you know, each time I tried to practice that, that is the result that I got. And life changed very dramatically, very quickly for me. And I remember I was like a month sober and, you know, people would be like, oh, this person doesn't have a sponsor. And I'd be like, well, I will take care of that for you. And people are like, Steph, no, like, just sit down with your month sober. You're so cute. And the point is like, I try to be helpful because this experience was so powerful. It was so powerful that I was gonna throw it at you, which some people don't like, by the way. So just keep that in mind. But anyway, it kept me going and things changed. Things did change quite a bit. And, you know, I've always had this difficulty with knowing how to be a friend and have successful relationships with people. Because I was just weird and awkward. Like, I think a lot of us are very awkward, and I just, like, I don't know how to talk to you. I don't know any of that. And I remember there was this one other girl, and she was sort of in the same boat, so we were just sort of like, you know, we'll hang out. You know, we just sort of tolerated each other until we became, like, best friends. Because we just, like, didn't know how to talk to people, so we were just like, okay, well, we're weird. Let's just hang out together. And we did, and we had so much fun. Like, we would come up to this meeting, we'd go into Philly, we'd go into Baltimore, we'd drive up to Amherst, Massachusetts, and we just drove everywhere, and that experience really taught me, God, how much fun there is to have here. That this is not a sentence, that there's joy and friendship and such camaraderie, and getting to share this kind of spiritual experience that you're having with other people along the way. Like, I just loved it. And I followed every suggestion that was given to the best of my ability. And, you know, one of those things, of course, was learning exactly the person that I was when I had come in here. And I don't know if anybody else can relate to this, but, like, my experience, I think some people come in and they're like, oh man, like, I need to go apologize. Like, I did some fucked up shit. But I came in here and I was under the impression that, you know, I was going to talk to some people and they were going to be like, oh my God, Steph, like, you should really go tell them to, like, apologize to you. And and I really thought that that's what was going to happen. And, you know, what I learned is that I am an absolutely self-obsessed wreck. Like, I will do anything I possibly can to get the effect that I am seeking, which is a little bit of relief. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it will hurt you. It doesn't matter if it will adversely affect you. I will do anything I possibly have to do to take care of me. So I step on the toes of my fellows. As you guys would say. And I really learned that. And, like, that was such a powerful experience for me because it's not enough to just know. Because if you just know, what are you going to do? Keep living that way? And then you're even more miserable, right? So, like, I found out, and I didn't feel too good about it. But what happened is it gave me an absolute desperation to change, to do whatever I had to do to make sure that I did not behave that way anymore. And, you know, part of that process was, of course, going up and trying to clean up some of the mess that I had made. Now, when I had first come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not on speaking terms with my parents, who is the only family that I have. in the United States. And, you know, we weren't speaking. About a year before I had gotten sober, my parents had asked me to come to their home because they wanted to tell me something. And they told me that my dad had been diagnosed with colon cancer. And I said, okay. And then I went into the bathroom to see if he had any of those fun cancer meds. And he did. You know, so that was the purpose of that. And of course, like, why would they want me there? Like, piece of shit. And, you know, so needless to say, I had a lot to clean up. And, you know, I think words are necessary. Like, I think the words were necessary, but not for me. Like, I think acknowledging the things that I had done wrong was necessary because it gave them the opportunity to say what they needed to say. And, my dad did. It was not the most comfortable thing to listen to. But it was necessary. But, you know, of course, the words mean very little unless they're followed by action. So I have awesome, you know, women surrounding me in AA, and these women are telling me, like, okay, both my parents were pretty sick. They were pretty sick at this time. So these people in AA were like, okay, you're going to show up at their house, you're going to take them to their doctor's appointments, you're going to take them, you're going to go grocery shopping for them, you're going to go to the pharmacy for them, you're going to clean their house, all these things, like all these different actions to take to make sure that I was being a good and present daughter, and I did all those things, because they told me to, not because I wanted to, but like I said, my problem has always been, like, I don't know how to have relationships with people, because when I talk to you, I mean, like I said from the beginning, like, I want you to validate me in some way. So, like, the extent of my, the conversation that I wanted to have with them at that time was, you know, I got 3 months sober. You want to talk about it?
Yeah.
and, I remember one day I was complaining about my dad to this woman. And she said, "Steph, do you ever ask him, like, how he's doing?" And I was like, "No." Like, isn't that awful? Like, it doesn't cross my mind to say, "How are you?" to a person who has cancer. Like, what can I do to help you? To a person who has cancer. Like, I just didn't do it. Like, I had no concept of the words that I needed to say. You know, so she said, like, "Why don't you start doing that? And then listen." You know, like, don't try to talk him out of whatever it happens to be. Listen. So I did that. And it wasn't the most comfortable thing, but it opened the door to conversation, right? And then once again, I remember I was talking to this woman, and I was once again bitching about something, and she said, "Do you ever tell your dad that you love him?" And I was like, "No, like, I don't really communicate like that." no, like, I don't think I had said that since I was, like, a little kid. And she said, "Do it." And I was pretty, like, steadfast that I was, like, absolutely never going to do that. But he happened to be in the hospital, and I remember I was, I had gone to see him in the hospital, and I was getting ready to leave, and the inspiration stroke, like, you have to tell your dad, you have to tell your dad that you love him, and, so I said it, like, awkwardly, of course, and, he didn't say anything back, and, and I walked outside, and I called that woman, and I was like, "I'm never fucking doing that again, like, that guy's an asshole." And she's like, "Are you going to see him tomorrow?" And I said, "Yeah, I have to." And she said, "Okay, you'll say again tomorrow." And I did. Because I just did everything they told me to do. Because it always was effective. Always. I wish I was still that willing. I'm not. But, you know, maybe one day. So anyway, my relationship with my dad changed. Like, eventually he said it back, which is awesome. Eventually he would say it before I had the opportunity to. And he actually died on my 1 year anniversary. And, you know, and for the first time in my life, like, I didn't make that about me. You know, I had absolutely no desire to use that as a means by which to create this, like, victim, "You must take care of me now, you must do everything I want from you." I did what the people in AA suggested, and I tried to be of service to my mom. And I tried to continue to be of service to people in AA. And like the beautiful thing about that is that the thought of drinking absolutely never crossed my mind, not once. And, you know, after my dad died, my mom was very sick, and I didn't really have the means to take care of her because she just needed a lot of care. So we decided she was going to move back to Brazil to be with our family there. There's thousands of them. They're breeders. And there was, you know, a lot of people that would be able to help with her care there. So we took her back there. And I stayed there for about 6 weeks with her. And she, you know, she was not in a good state when I left as far as her schizophrenia. And she had tried to, you know, commit suicide before I left. She just wasn't well. And I had gotten back home, and not long after that, they're like, you need to come back, because she, you know, is not doing well, and, you know, she ended up dying. This was 6 months after my dad died, and I didn't used to tell this because I didn't think it was relevant, and the reason I tell it now is because, do you guys ever call your sponsor, and you're like, okay, this is the one time, they're going to be like, you're right. You deserve to feel that way. And, you know, what happened was, my family in Brazil, they live in the favelas and the ghettos in Brazil. They don't have money. They see me as the person who grew up in the United States who has money, right? So what had happened is that these people said, you know, we're not going to tell you what hospital your mom is in if you don't give us this X amount of money. When she ended up dying, we're not going to give you her remains unless you give us X amount of money. I still don't know where her remains are. And it was a very unfortunate set of circumstances and a very painful set of circumstances. And absolutely one of the most prevalent set of circumstances in my life that gave me that feeling of entitlement that I could say they deserve to be hated by me. And you know, there may be some people that agree with me on that, but the big book tells me that I do not have that luxury, and I certainly do not. You know, the experience I had when my dad died was that I practiced the principles that are detailed for us in our program, and I was sad, but I was okay, you know? I wasn't thinking about drinking. I wasn't thinking about using that as a solution. Now, when my mom died and I decided to embrace this hatred of these people, it took about 2 days before I remember I was sitting in the car and I put my hands on the side and I was squeezing as tight as I could because I could not stand to be sober anymore. And some outside circumstances happened that prevented me from drinking. And I do believe that that was God, because my intention, absolutely, and I tried. I was just prevented. I won't get into the details of that, but you can certainly ask about it if you want. I certainly tried. My intention was to drink as much as I could so that I could die. And that was my intention. And I tried that for about 2 days. And then somebody picked me up from my house. I was living in the middle of the woods, and I didn't have a car at that time. It had broken down, and somebody picked me up and drove me to my sponsor's house, and I get to her house, and she gives me a hug, because who doesn't deserve a hug? But she didn't say, like, I'm sorry, like, those people are assholes. She didn't say any of that. She didn't say a word. She gave me a hug, and then she handed me a piece of pencil, a pencil and a piece of paper, and she told me to write an inventory, which once again I thought was absolutely scandalous. Like, what? I'm sorry, you think your little fourth and fifth step is going to fix this problem? And I was so angry. Like, I just, how dare you think that this will solve this problem? And I don't know why. I just sat there and I wrote it. And then after I wrote it, I talked about it with her. And then after I talked about it with her, she sat me on her couch and she said, "You're going to be quiet for an hour while I go take a bath." And I don't know why, but I just sat there and I did it. And And I won't say that that experience removed the pain that I had been experiencing. It didn't. But I had enough of a perspective change that all of a sudden drinking and killing myself wasn't the most prominent thought that I was having. You know? And I kept going. And, you know, I remember she said to me, and this may have been like a little bit later, I remember she said, like, one day you're going to be able to use this experience to benefit somebody else. I'm like, don't you hate it when people say that? especially when you're going through something that's like very painful. You're like, shut up. And I just was so mad. but I just kept moving, right? And, you know, through this experience of losing my parents, like what ended up happening is a sponsor that I had, like about 9 months later, she had one of her cousins committed suicide. And then another cousin of hers committed suicide, and I got to do the same things for her that she had done for me, and which I don't want to say that it was a lot, you know, it wasn't. It was just, you know, I'll let you cry if you need to cry. I'll give you a hug if you need a hug. But if you start slipping into some delusion and some fantasy world that you deserve to feel sorry for yourself, then I'm just going to hand you a piece of paper and a pencil. And you know, it's given me the opportunity to sponsor a lot of women who have been going through similar circumstances. And not only do I get to see how my experience with alcoholism, like directly with my drinking and being unable to stop drinking and sobriety being awful until I experience the solution, I get to share that with women. But now I also get to share this with women. And it's given me like a, you know, a really amazing connection with a lot of women. And I'm so grateful that I have that, because nobody should feel alone in that circumstance ever. And I don't anymore, which is the most powerful thing about AA. I think I'm talking quite a bit. I'm going a little over time, but I'm just going to say this. I do not expect, you know, if you are suffering from alcoholism and you think that there is no hope from you, I don't really expect for you to walk up to anybody in this room and say, like, hey, take me through the steps, because that's just a rarity. I don't know if that's ever happened to me. I've been sober for 7 years. But if you stand there long enough, like in the corner, then the people will help you. Like, there is something to be offered here, like something beautiful. And not only can you get sober, but you can be comfortable with that. You can be happy with that, which is always the problem, isn't it? That we go back to the alcohol because the sobriety is so heavy. So what Alcoholics Anonymous has the ability to do is to teach you that sobriety can be light and fun, and you can have a sense of purpose. And that's what it's given me, and I do believe that that's the reason I'm sober today, because I do call that a spiritual awakening, a feeling of usefulness. So that's all I have. Thanks.